Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, I'll be speaking with Ron Bailey, one of the funniest and most pointed critics of the politicization of science in America. His latest book is Liberation Biology, the Scientific and Moral Case for the Biotech Revolution. Ron is a writer for Reason magazine, and you can read his weekly column at reason.com. So stay tuned for a conversation with Ron Bailey. I'm speaking today with Ron Bailey. Ron is one of the leading science correspondents in the country today. He writes for Reason magazine, science and technology reader there. And what was your previous book, Earth Watch?
Earth Report 2000.
Earth Report 2000, which was a review of some of the environmental progress that has been made over the last 20, 30 years. And this current book that you just released is Liberation Biology, the Scientific and Moral Case for the Biotech Revolution. And I'm really glad to have you with us today.
Delighted to be with you.
I want to say right off the bat that I've learned so much from you over the last 5 years because your columns in Reason, as I said, are some of the best science reporting that I know of, some of the most impassioned partisan reporting, and that's the kind of people you usually learn from, so congratulations on that.
Well, thank you very much. Flattery will get you everywhere.
Good. And you also started off this book with a term which I must have learned from you, but it's also in my book, biopolitics, the notion that some of the left-right divisions that we have taken for granted in the last century will be at least added to, if not supplanted, by a new set of divisions over the role of biotech in society. So just to define what you see as the parameters, sometimes you've talked about it as the party of life versus the party of death, but maybe that's a little bit too fast. So what do you see as the parameters of the new biopolitics?
Well, basically, let me go at it this way. One of the things that I find fascinating is that there is a kind of left-right alliance forming in opposition to biotechnological progress and the use of biotechnology for enhancing and improving human lives. And part of that is, if you will, they come at it differently, but they come to the same result. On the left, the basic fear is the normal fear of egalitarians everywhere, that somehow or other this is going to further oppress poor people or minorities and that kind of thing, and that biotechnology will, in fact, exacerbate differences between people, and therefore they would like to oppose it for that reason. And on the right, basically, biotechnology is opposed because it upsets traditional hierarchies. It upsets the order of society and notions and fixed notions of human nature. And so, but while they come at it differently, they do come to the same place. And I find it fascinating when you see Jeremy Rifkin, who is a well-known leftist, writing editorials against biotechnology with William Kristol, who's the editor of the Weekly Standard.
That is fascinating. And one of the other things that has happened recently that kind of shook things up was that Bill Frist, you told me today, I hadn't seen it, but apparently he's endorsed intelligent design. We'll get to that in a second. But Bill Frist surprised a lot of conservatives by coming over to the embryonic stem cell debate. Now, you know, this is the embryonic stem cell debate has largely been a division on the old reproductive rights versus abortion politics grounds. Do you see this new biopolitics being reflected in that as well? And is Frist's flip flop part of this, or what's going on there?
Well, I think, but in the case of Frist, is that he's a politician, and I don't see a deep philosophical thing. I think he checked the polls and discovered that 2/3 of Americans are in favor of the research and decided, well, maybe I should get on that side of the debate so that I can get some votes when I run for president in 2008. So I don't think it's a deep philosophical thing that's going on with Frist in this regard.
The abortion part of this politics with the embryonic stem cells and some of the other issues, it's reflected a secular versus religious split. So
right.
To what extent is biopolitics really just one manifestation of the red-blue secular-religious split in the country?
Well, I think that you put your finger on it. There's a lot of that going on. In a sense, I think what's happening right now is that the United States is going through the fourth Great Awakening, that there is, you know, the Great Awakenings are these religious revival movements that afflict the United States every two generations or so. And I think we're going through that right now. And one of the things that people are doing is trying to turn religion to find, you know, eternal verities in a world that they find moving too fast. And biotechnology is seen by some people as threatening all kinds of settled questions, supposedly. And I think that you're right, that religious values are informing this debate, even when people are trying to formulate their arguments against biotechnology in secular terms. The subtext really is a kind of religious rejectionism.
I know that you're familiar with Ted Peters, who's a Lutheran theologian out in California, who's argued for co-creator theology. And even though I'm not a believer, every time I get asked about the religious dimensions of these questions, I point to Ted.
Right.
I just wonder how indicative his theological view that human beings were given reason for a reason to improve the human condition, how indicative that's going to be of any a future theological realignment, or just the religious going to continue to pull in into their shell and go off into the past?
Right. Well, what's interesting, of course, and again in the embryonic stem cell debate, you can find that many of the mainstream or mainline, I guess, Christian Protestant denominations have come out in favor of the research. The Episcopal Church, for example, the Presbyterians and the Methodists have all come out in favor of the research. But the people who are dominating the debate on the religious side are the evangelicals and the Roman Catholics.
Another dimension of this biopolitics, it's interesting, another recent book that just came out is The Republican War on Science by Chris Mooney, who's kind of you're the Democratic equivalent of what you do for the classical liberal side. And Chris argues, I think, that and cogently, that a lot of folks who have been supporters of science and technology in the past have been appalled by the Republicans' turn away from science and reason, and the intelligent design debate is just another example of that. And does this reflect a kind of a realignment of science and engineers and well-educated men who like the space program suddenly realizing that the Republicans aren't their best buddies?
I think there's something to that as well. What else is going on there, though, I think, is that in our society, in a secular liberal society, and we are still basically that, the one argument that seems to be the one source of authority that we still have is science. So basically what people do and have been doing is saying, you know, studies show X, and therefore we should do Y. And if you can get science on your side on any particular issue, then you've won the debate, or you think you've won the debate. And so now science has been thoroughly politicized, that essentially politicians go at science on both sides because they know that that's the source of authority in our society. And I think that it's a terrible, terrible development for our country.
Well, you've come at it from both sides because you're also critical of some of the paradigmatic commitments that environmental scientists have had or climate scientists. So you acknowledge that there is a problem with paradigms in the scientific community. And does that give you any smattering of sympathy with the intelligent design argument that they...
No.
No sympathy.
No sympathy whatsoever.
Okay, good. By the way, the latest church out there is the Pastafarians, believers in that the universe was created by the great pasta monster in the sky. And there's a $250,000 award out there for anybody who can prove that it wasn't.
Wasn't true. Yes. Aside from the book, I did go down because I was fascinated by this debate. I went down and spent 3 days in Lynchburg, Virginia, at Liberty University, going to the Creation Mega Conference, and listening to people who literally believe and argue that the world was created 6,000 years ago in 24-hour days, and that the flood was real, and that dinosaurs and human beings lived together.
More power to them.
Yes.
Now, I'm speaking with Ron Bailey. He's the author of Liberation Biology, The Scientific and Moral Case for the Biotech Revolution. And for most of my listenership, your enthusiasms and optimistic scenarios won't come as a terrible shock, although for many people that I talk to, it still does come as a terrible shock. But you basically agree that in the next 30 years, we'll have treatments that will create negligible senescence or anti-aging and that will be able to cure most diseases and things like that? Or are there particular aspects of biotech that you're less optimistic about, or you think we're going to have this thing wrapped up?
I think it's going to have to be a hard slogging fight every step of the way, unfortunately. I think that we're up against a part of human nature. We're fairly conservative species. And in a certain sense, I think that's why we managed to survive ice ages and so forth. And so what's happening is, if you go, and I know you're familiar with this, if you look at biomedical advances over the last two centuries, whenever vaccinations came in, they were resisted, and there were riots against that. People argued against anesthesia during childbirth because the Bible said that women should bear children in pain. Condoms were made illegal in the United States to be shipped across state lines for more than a century. The pill was illegal in your home state of Connecticut, where you're located, up until 1968. And in vitro fertilization was resisted. So we all this progress, I'm positive, will happen, but it's going to be a fight.
You've written about the Human Fertility and Embryology, Embryo Authority in the UK.
Right, it's the Human Embryology and Fertilization Authority.
Human Embryology and Fertilization Authority. And that's one of the models that the bioconservatives like Francis Fukuyama have suggested as a way to regulate the kind of reproductive science that they don't like happening in the United States. By the way, one of the chapters I like in your book is Hooray for Designer Babies. I like that. I have a chapter in my book called Hooray for Ritalin, so we're on the same page there. But I'm sure you're also recently surprised, as many were, that the HEFA endorsed a broad liberalization or many kinds of liberalization of the use of reproductive technology. So it doesn't seem like some of the regulatory apocalyptic scenarios, you know, that these agencies would necessarily be captured by bioconservatives and stop all progress, at least in that particular instance, have come to pass.
No, and actually my understanding is they're about to start reviewing some of the legislation on which the agency is founded. It's not a done deal that they're going to, in fact, change these rules, but I think they probably will, and it does make me more optimistic. The problem with a regulatory agency like the Human Embryology and Fertilization Authority isn't so much a regulation from the point of view of safety or efficacy or quality, which are certainly things that I think governments can legitimately regulate. The problem is that with the Human Embryology and Fertilization Authority is they smuggle in values. They tell people, well, you can't use these technologies because our community is against this particular thing. And, for example, sex selection of embryos was one of the things that they forbade. And that's always what bothers me. When we have, in a liberal society, competing values, what we try to do is accommodate and tolerate people whose values are different from our own. And unfortunately, the regulatory model that had existed in Britain and the one that the bioconservatives like would be an agency that would, in fact, impose their values on people.
Well, when I read Fukuyama's Our Post-Human Future, and he said in there that he didn't think that the FDA was an adequate regulatory agency because it precisely what you said, that it only is empowered to regulate on the basis of safety and efficacy and not on the basis of values. I began to argue to my tech enthusiast friends that's precisely why we should get behind the FDA having the authority to regulate things like cloning and designer babies, because those are the appropriate grounds on which they should be regulated.
Now, I'm not going to get into a fierce fight with you about that. That's fine.
Well, I mean, you don't have to have a fierce fight, but I know that you're also critical of the FDA. And is your criticism more that it's not an efficient agency at clearing these kinds of technologies?
Yeah, that would be basically it. It's essentially the problem with regulatory agencies and regulatory theory, and this is something that economists have known for quite some time, is that regulatory agencies are inherently conservative. And the reason they're conservative is that if something goes wrong, they get a lot more trouble than if something goes right. So they're always much more erring on the side of safety than they need to. And I think it slows down and stifles the development of technology.
Well, you might be surprised to learn I'm writing a paper right now arguing for a massive rethink of clinical trials, because I think clinical trials are way too conservative, and that one of the things that we should be doing is letting people have much more liberal access to experimental substances with a quid pro quo that they participate in intensive monitoring of what happens to them. But and I think the FDA is very conservative around that. But trying to think about the political context in which an argument for any kind of deregulation of access to these devices and drugs, when we have Vioxx and all these other kinds of scandals out there, it just seems very hard to make the case that the FDA should be deregulated in any way.
I understand what you're saying, and the problem is that, of course, you have Vioxx. On the other hand, you had, over the time period that Vioxx was approved, you've probably had 150 other drugs that are out there that are now being used by people that are not problematic, and you might have had even more if they weren't already so conservative. There's no way that people are able to come up with a system to guarantee that these types of technologies will work perfectly the first time out. If that were a requirement, we will have no new technologies.
I agree. One of the other things that the regulatory agencies have enshrined is the distinction between therapy and enhancement, which
right.
makes it much harder for an alleged enhancement use of these technologies to cut the mustard. Do you think that that's something that we'll be able to? Is there any rethink in the folks that you're talking to in the regulatory environment that's an illegitimate distinction to make?
Not so far as I can see. The problem is that the way that our agencies are set up and the regulations are set up, for example, if you had a BAFO treatment that was anti-aging treatment, you would not be able to roll that out unless it had an indication for some disease, because aging isn't considered to be a disease. So basically what you're having is, for example, if somebody is devising some molecules that they believe, and I've talked to a lot of people who believe that these molecules will in fact help retard aging, they have to justify it as, well, it cures, Alzheimer's, or it'll help heal your skin faster or something like that. And so what will happen is the FDA will approve it for, those reasons, and then a lot of us will, I hope, start using them off-label for the real purposes, which would be to retard aging.
I'm speaking with Ron Bailey. He's the author of Liberation Biology, The Scientific and Moral Case for the Biotech Revolution, and you can read his columns at reason.com.
Every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday.
Yeah.
I didn't know you had a regular schedule. There's a study out last week, speaking of this therapy enhancement, that showed that half a dozen different amphetamines, including ecstasy, were good at slowing the progress of Parkinson's. And what my imagination immediately was fired up, that what if it was shown that taking ecstasy was good for reducing your risk of ever developing a neurodegenerative disease, what that would do to the regulatory environment.
I understand it. It's very odd that in this society we have approved molecules that are that we can use, like alcohol and caffeine and so forth. And caffeine is an enhancer. In fact, a lot of the drugs that are being researched for enhancing memory go along those pathways. And then we have molecules which are denigrated, and it's kind of random. And it seems to be based on some puritanical notion of what it is that people are supposed to do, that there is a human nature that you're not allowed to modify in some sense. And I think that distinction is going to be going away in the future.
One of the wonderful chapters in your book is Changing Your Own Mind, The Neuroethics of Psychopharmacology. And I know that you and I are in complete agreement about deregulation of access to psychopharmaceuticals. And I have always thought that one of the ways that we would get to deregulation was that the crippling burden of our prison industrial complex and our extremely high rate of incarceration would eventually force fiscal conservatives and everybody else to see the injustice of this. On the other hand, what seems to have happened, and this kind of illustrates some of your classical liberal points, the prison industrial complex is a much stronger lobby for those kinds of policies and the law enforcement agencies and all the rest than the folks who would benefit from a decriminalization. And so what do you think breaks the impasse on that kind of an issue once you have this entrenched lobby for this disastrous policy? I'm asking you to be an actual partisan person trying to craft a policy. I know that you're more of a critic, but
right.
if you were to advise the Dems or the Republicans or the Libertarians about how to do this, how would you go about it?
I suppose what I would do is if I were the Democratic Party, I would go and point out that the constituencies that make up part of the Democratic Party, often minority groups and so forth, that this policy is decimating those communities, and try to get them to turn around on that basis. It's very hard at this point. I have to say the baby boom generation, the people who enjoyed sex, drugs, and rock and roll when they were in college, are eagerly trying to prevent their children from having the same experiences. And it's a real political impasse, I'm afraid, at this point.
This is one of the places where I definitely do see a long, hard slog. But on the other hand, I sometimes get very enthusiastic and optimistic, because when we actually do have cures for aging on the
right.
table, when we actually do have cures for muscular dystrophy and all these other diseases, I can't imagine there being any popular support for a Cassian, you know, sickness, aging, and death are the best things that ever happened to the human race kind of argument. Most
right.
people are going to sign on to the agenda and just move the goalposts a little bit further out and say, well, when I was talking about post-humanity, I meant that next thing down the pike.
I think you're right. The good news is that, at least in our country, we're basically, Americans are pragmatists. And the way I think about stem cell research is the first time a South Korean gets to walk again because embryonic stem cells were used to fix their broken backs, that's the end of the debate in the United States. That's what happened in vitro fertilization when Louise Joy Brown was born, for example. In England, all of a sudden, 2 years later, we had fertility clinics all over the country. And the same thing will happen in the stem cell debate, and I think it'll happen for each of these technologies. The other good news is, I think, is that the biotechnology is not going to be confined just to the United States, and there are lots of other competing countries. I mean, Britain is going great guns on this area, for example, as is South Korea. Singapore seems to be heading in that direction, and China as well. And I think that basically these successes abroad will feed back into the United States, and basically, there's no way that these technologies will be bottled up.
Well, you mentioned China, and this is one of my dystopian scenarios for the future.
Yes, I can imagine.
not just for me, I assume, but for you also, the notion that technologically revved up China would be a new authoritarian capitalist model for the world, as opposed to the more open societies we'd like to see.
No, I'm. There is a big argument to be made there. The problem is that if you want the technologies to be developed in an ethical, safe way, you would prefer they be developed in the United States. And unfortunately, by our go-slow bioconservative policies, we may be allowing a different model, as you say, the Chinese model of development of these technologies, and we may not like the results of that.
Leon Kass, last fall, he tried to float an agenda to the Republican Congress that was a manifestation, a political legislative agenda that was a manifestation of what he and the other neoconservatives have been developing in the president's council. And it went over like a lead balloon, not only because they didn't like him crossing that line, but it didn't seem that they thought that agenda had very much political sense to it. And now Frist has switched sides, at least on this embryonic stem cell issue.
Right.
Do you think that Kassism is on the wane, or is there still a nexus out there that we should be worried about?
I think it probably is on the wane. I'm a little more optimistic about it now because, again, the polls show that whenever you make these proposals to the American public, particularly on stem cells, that they're in favor of using spare embryos left over from fertility research for stem cell research, and I think the politicians will be paying attention to that. The vexed debate over reproductive rights is going to continue for the foreseeable future, and it's just going to be something our culture hashes out time and time again.
One final issue. Let's talk a little bit about reproductive cloning. You did some great writing on this back when the Raelians and some of the others were wandering around the world, and it stands out there as one of these yuck factor issues that's completely irrational because its impact on the future would be so minimal if
right.
people actually adopted it. But, it's extremely difficult to argue against you know, to argue for a consistent approach to reproductive rights, for instance, even with staunch feminists, when you get to issues like reproductive cloning and sex selection, the, you know, these mental barriers just go up. And I was wondering if you had any tips for those of us on the side of reason and individual autonomy about your rhetorical strategies. What's been working for you when you argue around? And you've got some great essays on the web, by the way, about sex selection as well. What's been working for you when you argue with people about these things?
Well, on sex selection, basically what you can do is make people feel comfortable by pointing out the actual times it's been used. In the United States, sex selection is vastly used to select for baby girls, and the usual concern is that you find among feminists and the unease that people have is this notion that apparently they're afraid that people actually use sex selection to select for boys, and in our culture and in Western Europe that doesn't seem to be the case, which is not to say it might not be a problem in as I understand it in Asian cultures, because already abortion is being used considerably for sex selection in India and China. But again, I think it's one of those kinds of things that cultures will evolve over time and realize that it's a kind of silly thing to do. So but for people in the United States to just allow their fellow Americans to use this technology for their families, I think it's very easy to win that debate by saying, well, the actual cases are, you know, we're not actually trying to create a world all of men in the United States. With regard to cloning, that one's a harder nut to crack. There is a kind of yuck factor to that I honestly don't know why people think delayed twins are a particular problem. On the other hand, slowly but surely, if you, again, watch the polls, more and more Americans are coming around to it, saying that it's okay. But it's still, a vast majority are still against reproductive cloning at this point.
What are you working on now?
Well, actually, I'm going to be going around giving a lot of talks about the book this fall, so that's one of the things. I guess the next article I'll be writing for the magazine is on peak oil and whether we've reached peak oil or not. So it's not a biotech article at all.
What's your position on that?
Well, I haven't got a position yet. I'm doing the research. I'm talking to all kinds of experts everywhere. My intuition, but again, I could be wrong, is that this is one of the periodic crises where we basically have the end of the age of oil declared, and we're probably not. It's probably not the case. And the studies I've looked at from the International Energy Agency, for example, project supplies of oil would not peak until around 2030 or thereabouts at current projections of use and production. But, you know, I'm talking to all these people who claim to have a different interpretation of the results, and I'll see what I think.
Excellent. Well, Ron is the author of Liberation Biology, The Scientific and Moral Case for the Biotech Revolution, and he writes and blogs at, you do blog occasionally.
I do.
Yeah, at reason.com. He's the science correspondent there, and I really want to thank you for coming on today.
I'm delighted to be with you. Let's do it again soon.
Let's do it. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.